Welcome. You're listening to the Three Left Show, a show coming for news and analysis from the radical left. I'm Dan Platt. Great to have you. So we're just going to start with a little banter about what kind of books we've been reading or media we've seen that piqued us. You could start. What have you been reading?
So I have just been reading it's called The End of Tsarist Russia. It's about the fall of the regime, the World War I, the coming of the revolution. Fascinating book. It was pitched as a Russian history of World War I, or the origins of World War I, I should say. And I found it very, very interesting. I think, you know, we in the West have a tendency to look at World War I through a very Western lens. That is to say, we focus on the Western Front. We focus on the confrontation between Germany and England and France. And we, you know, we lose sight of, you know, some of the deeper origins of World War I in the Balkans, in the relationship between Russia and Austria. Russia and Austria, Russia and Serbia, Russia and Germany, Germany and Austria. We sort of lose the kind of larger geopolitical, you know, context, especially here in America, where I think we tend basically to ignore, I think, World War I right up until 1917, right up until America gets into the war, you know, and we sort of don't.
Otherwise, the conversation is about how we stayed out of it.
Exactly right. Of course, it's the case in both wars that, and of course, we have a much better idea about this in World War II than World War I, just because of when public opinion polling sort of originated. But, you know, through anecdotal evidence, I mean, I think it's the judgment of historians anyway, I think is pretty unanimous that on the eve of World War I, this general sentiment in America was to stay out of it. And the same was true in World War II. The general sentiment on the eve of the war was, you know, hey, let's stay out of it. And I think, you know, there's especially in America, there's this tendency that, you know, we can afford to ignore the rest of the world. When we tell these stories, you know, we tend to pick them up only from where our part in them
begins.
And I think, you know, especially to understand the 20th century, I mean, it's very, very important, I think, you know, for Americans to get outside of that kind of way of thinking.
Especially since before those wars, we didn't have a wartime economy to worry about. No one's job was on the line. What if we stayed out in Iraq?
Well, again,
not as many, at least.
Well, again, that's one of those, I think, you know, really hypocritical, beliefs that people can really have on this subject. You know, I think when you take these wider views, it becomes really more, you know, the question becomes, were we really not part of the war between 1914 and 1917? And I think the sober-minded analysis says, yeah, actually, we were in the war, because the amount of supplies, and, you know, especially military supplies, and you know, loans is also, that we were giving to the, you know, Britain and France, and of course also Russia, we were on a side. We certainly were helping. Again, like, not that I think we probably wouldn't have sold stuff to the Germans if that were practical.
I thought we did.
During World War I, we sold some, but again, getting it through a British blockade was a different matter. And so there's only so much you could actually do. So, well, again, I don't think we didn't sell to Germany out of, you know, principle, per se, at least, you know, in the start.
So it was called The End of Tsarist Russia.
End of Tsarist Russia, the march to World War I and revolution. It's about, you know, really, it's about the collapse of an empire. And again, I think for me, the big takeaway, you know, again, as someone, again, who likes this broader context, I think it makes World War I look very different. I mean, not that it sort of changes any of these maybe the dominant themes of World War I, but, you know, look, World War I really starts because you have three empires crumbling. And, you know, it's no coincidence that Bosnia and Herzegovina and Sarajevo are right in the kind of Bermuda Triangle. This sort of, like, seeing how World War I emerges out of, again, a kind of what you might call a geopolitical Bermuda Triangle between three crumbling empires, the Austro-Hungarian, the Russian Romanov, and the Ottoman empires, and how their mm-hmm. Co-respective dissolutions ends up leading to a situation, in which the world eventually, becomes a larger European and eventually world conflagration.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very interesting, again, I think, especially for understanding the history of the 20th century.
Do you think there's anything that can apply to our current situation, end of empires and such?
Well, I think if we're talking about America, I think we have more instructive lessons in sort of the late Roman Republic. But, to me, I think the biggest present day takeaway should be that in World War I, one of the biggest forces at play is ethnic nationalism. And I think it's absolutely fair to say that, 100 years later, we are still grappling with the consequences. We are still struggling with the realities and sort of the political practices and practical realities of what ethnic nationalism means. And part of what made these empires crumble, part of what was making them weak internally, was the rise of ethnic nationalism and the question that it posed to multi-ethnic empires basically two political systems that were centuries old and whose legitimacy
were states with various or areas of with various cultures. So I'll move to what I've been reading, or what I finished, which was David Graeber's Utopia of Rules, and it's a book about bureaucracy, a critique of it from the left. Usually bureaucracy is something that right wingers complain about, red tape or big bloated government, and usually it's up to liberals and lefties to defend such a bureaucracy. But certainly it really helps to have a critique, especially when bureaucracy is so costly, as well as it has its own problems and contradictions. So overall, the title comes from the fact that bureaucracy is a sort of utopia, that there is a general myth, an ideal of what bureaucracy is for, which is that if we simplify human relations down to forms that you can fill out and a general, very strict set of rules, that interactions between government and citizens will be fair and honest and without bias. But this is impossible. It has never happened, and he makes the case that it never can. He uses various examples, but generally, he talks about how when we go into, we love fantasy media like Star Wars and Lord of the Rings, because you never see any bureaucracy. It's an escapist from bureaucracy. It's just the actions of our heroes and our villains. But on the other hand, when it comes to gaming, like fantasy RPGs and D&D, Dungeons & Dragons, it's very bureaucratic. There's rules, there's graphs. So he talks about the back and forth between games with rules, and we like games because they have rules, and we know the rules, and if we're all following the rules, then it's fair, unlike life. And that's the kind of thinking that, say Trump supporters have, that they've been following the rules, or I've been following rules personally, and I haven't gotten anywhere, and I've only lost. And then he compares that with play. Play has a lack of rules, but it's also creative. And so he talks about how, in another chapter, how the left is a creative side, while being conservative is not so much about destroying, but at least keeping things static and not so much creating. It's against creating new forms of social relations, creating new, if not infrastructure, institutions. And it's like, new institutions, it's bad. It's foreign. I don't know it. Another topic in a later chapter, each chapter is kind of a essay with its own point, he talks about Batman and constituent force. Constituent force refers to where power comes from, like the ability to, like the law itself. So going from like this idea that no system can create itself, take a step back, we follow laws, who makes the laws? Apparently representatives, the people, the government, How they derive their power, the Constitution. Well, how did the Constitution come to be? A series of illegal acts. And this is something that most Americans never think about or grapple with, and it's something we should think about. Where does power come from? And he points out that only the extreme left and right have an answer for this. The right, their answer is power comes from our, you know, from violence, our ability to use force on others. And the left usually come how, you know, we can go past the law, we can work outside the law by being nonviolent. Or I can break the law as it's stated by, say, not being aggressive, by carrying out passive resistance. Interesting parts that jumped out at me. So next, as a topic, we're going to kind of do a news story that's pretty recent, which is at the recent Golden Globes Awards. Meryl Streep, when she accepted an award, I don't know for what. I think it was probably Best Actress or Supporting or what have you. But she kind of called out Donald Trump. You know, she attacked him for being a bully and kind of especially referred to other things. And it's being hailed as something powerful. She's taking on Donald Trump, but from the radical left like me, and there's other voices, we're taking issue with this, not because of the message that she has, which is rather positive, but just the hypocrisy that if you're going to be compassionate, you should spread that out and speak out against war, that you should speak out against the harm that Democrats cause. When they cut welfare, when they vote with Republicans to strip people of entitlements or rights. Nick here is looking it up. You can read it out. Okay. To find it.
He's wanted to read out what she actually said. I mean,
Yeah, there's a particular passage that's
So apparently what she says is
being shared the most.
Quote, "There was one performance this year that stunned me. It sank its hooks in my heart. Not because it was good. There was nothing good about it, but it was effective and it did its job. It was that moment when the person asking to sit in the most respected seat in our country imitated a disabled reporter, someone he outranked in privilege, power, and the capacity to fight back." End quote.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, so yeah.
And then she talked about, like, you know, he's a bully, he's this, you know, there's nothing nice about it. I'll bring up that someone else was saying this, that someone wrote the piece about, you know, how the liberals or the left in America should not make the same mistake as the opposition in Italy. A man named Berlusconi was prime minister for a very long time. He was also a playboy billionaire. One story that was shared quite, that spread out was that he was holding bunga bunga parties, and he's, you know, he's having all of these, you know, he lives like Trump.
He had an underage sex scandal. I mean, that's right. Berlusconi is kind of a
slimeball.
Yeah.
And for years, but he kept being reelected, or rather stayed in power.
The guy formed and funded his own party. So, I mean, yeah. You know, right, it's kind of a vanity project. And
but the opposition couldn't make any headway. And this guy was making the case, an Italian, I believe, that the opposition would always put the focus on Berlusconi and his problems as a person. And they wouldn't talk policy. And I fear that our liberal class, and hopefully not the left also, but certainly those that call themselves progressives, are doing something very similar. That they are... And I know I'm just saying this as a warning, not to do that.
You're right in the sense that there's a smug section of liberals. I don't call it maybe not a smug. There's a group of people who look at Donald Trump and say, you know, and again, not incorrectly, this man is a horrible fucking individual. He is an utterly atrocious human being who has no reason whatsoever. No credentials, no anything to be sitting in again, as Meryl Streep said, the highest chair, you know, in the country. You know, this is not the man for the job under any stretch of the imagination. You know, this guy would get tossed out in the first round of a kind of objective, you know, job hunt to fill this vacancy.
Except his very program was about job hunting.
But again, you know, for... It, these people expect that his own deficiencies that are glaring to them and are glaring for all to see, but they're expecting that other people are going to share their commitment to these values and ideals. And that's what broke down. That's what broke the hearts of so many of these liberals, is that,
and Michelle Obama,
is that now they had to look at their fellow citizens in the face and know for sure this time that their fellow citizens are, in fact, a great deal of them, if not actual white supremacists, totally comfortable with living with and next to and voting for president white supremacists, so long as those white supremacists, you know, promise to solve their own parochial concerns. Yeah. You know, and I think that's...
like economic hardship, over, you know, over bureaucracy.
And so, you know, you're right. It's never going to do. It's never going to work for liberals to say, oh, you know, look at what Trump said here. How offensive is that? The people who support him are not going to care.
He should be impeached. Yeah. I keep hearing this.
He should be impeached.
Why does it matter if he's impeached?
He's never going to be impeached. Like, I mean, let's just, should he be impeached? Well, he hasn't, technically he can't. I don't think president-elects can, you have to assume the job before you can be impeached.
Well, let's just say,
constitutional lawyer.
Before the year is out. That's kind
of
like,
the time frame to put at on. Some point in his presidency, will he do something that's impeachable? Yeah, totally. But you know what? They almost, you know, Obama did, W did. I mean, it's not like that will be something new, you know.
Especially when it comes to breaking the Constitution,
so, yeah,
fridging on it, rewriting it, but without unless, any but, kind of mandate.
But the reality is, liberals can crow all they want about how he should this and how he. It's a Republican-controlled Congress. Do you think the Republicans are going to impeach him? Not a chance in hell. Not so like
it's weird they don't consider that.
Stop crying about how he should be impeached. He's not going to be impeached. You know what I mean? Let's just let's all just accept that. That at least.
And how are they going to retake Congress by just keep saying
he should be impeached? He should,
or that, or just how, look how terrible you know, Republicans are.
I mean,
well, obviously it didn't work the last 6 years.
Granted, no, maybe the Democrats look at Hillary winning the popular vote by 3 million and they say, okay, yeah, well, there we go.
Most of which were in one state.
In the midterms, you know, that'll be our strategy. We'll run it on the impeachment. You know, vote for us. We'll impeach Trump. Or, you know, we'll push that agenda. And maybe they will get a big protest anti-Trump vote. Who knows?
I think that's what Hillary got last year, though. Isn't that at least half of her votes were basically not Trump votes. Just as many Trump votes were not Hillary votes.
I mean,
polls were like half and half. That's what the polls were since last summer. Jill Stein would quote them endlessly.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, I'm not a pollster. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't follow all the polls.
It's hard. To trust them as totally accurate.
You know, so I don't exactly know what to say about, you know, what people actually thought. All I can say is, in the end, close to 3 million more people voted for Hillary Clinton than for Donald Trump, and so, you know, again, maybe the Democrats, yeah, can hope that combined with the anger that Trump is certain to stoke over the next 2 years, just being himself, you know, maybe they have a chance. But will it be a huge wave that gets them?
But what if policy-wise he does nothing? And I was considering this, since a lot of his promises he's basically backing away from already. What if he does nothing? Now, of course, Republicans, and there'll be the little tweaks in each of the departments that basically harm the environment, that harm labor rights. But what if Trump, as a public figure, as the president, basically doesn't have any press conferences, doesn't announce any policy, doesn't only basically tweets personal or like little petty conflict things?
Are you really worried about that? I'm not. I expect Donald Trump to continue to be a petulant little baby.
Well, I'm saying, what do Democrats run on if Trump does nothing?
Trump, I think there's a very low likelihood that Trump does nothing. Mm. Because let's face it, I think one of the dangerous things that many people see in Trump is that here's a man whose lack of scruple is so thoroughgoing, or, you know, that his self-interest is so myopically focused on himself that he's got no policy agenda per se to speak of, that he's a blank canvas that those around him will get to write in. So there'll be plenty of people who will have his ear, who will have pet policies and projects that he can help them advance. And Donald Trump, being Donald Trump, I'm sure will be happy to, you know, accumulate favors and you know, build up markers and you know, try to do things for his rich and powerful friends who have, you know, genuine policy axes to grind. But again, where are those axes to grind? Taxes, regulation, right? Two of the more myopic and esoteric,
convoluted
sections of law and areas of policy that,
because there's a lot of bureaucracy
that bewilder the average person. You know, that even that you have to be a specialist kind of, you know, to understand. You know, again, to call these bureaucracies Byzantine, right? This is exactly what we have that word for.
The very thing that's meant to bring us fairness actually brings us the opposite.
Well, not that it doesn't bring us fairness, but it's hard to
get, reinforces
to get a good view of how these institutions work.
Sure. Right?
It's just they're just not the most transparent or easily transparent from the outside.
Keeps them opaque. I was saying to a friend in a rant of my own that if not for his money, Trump is simply another broken individual. And without his money, he'd be some kind of addict or something. So why is everyone, the attention should not be on him. It's basically like, you know, pointing and laughing or being mad about someone who's broken when there's also a system that's broken.
It's just not going to be an effective tactic. I mean, you know, people are going to be trying for the next 2 to 4 years. You know, you're going to see a lot of these gotcha stories of, ha-ha, we liberals, we've caught Trump in a conflict of interest. Guess what? He's going to shrug it off.
Didn't they spend the last year doing that?
Exactly.
Didn't they spend the last year doing that? Basically catching him all this terrible things he says.
The New York Times and the Washington Post, this is honestly the only thing that they can do. That's their game is, ha, we gotcha, and they're going to keep hoping. And all the liberals are going to keep hoping that all those people out there who, again, put their own parochial economic quote-unquote middle class, hate that term, concerns on one side of the scale, and Trump's obvious and vile and unabashed and unvarnished racism, misogyny, and xenophobia, and decided, you know what? I can live with the latter, you know, as long as he's going to take care of the former. And
you don't have to say middle class. You can kind of, you can use identity politics as a general kind of umbrella, even though identity politics for the last 40 years have been good. Now they've reached their limit on what they can do for us politically. At least that's what I've heard from some other thinkers, I suppose. If I may, for a moment, rant about Keith Olbermann. I watched a little bit of his like newest video from his like resistance series, and if I may joke, the promo image for this his new show, The Resistance, and it's him. I don't know how much clothes he's wearing, but he's basically draped the American flag over himself, and he's kind of huddled in a fetal position pose. His video,
that's Keith Olbermann, all right.
His video was him simply speaking in his usual vociferous tone, where he's in just like Maddow, saying a lot, or rather saying little by talking for 8 minutes. And it was mostly about his main general point was that Trump is a broken individual. And he's apparently questioning Republicans. His message is for Republicans as if they watch him.
Yeah,
and,
or as if they would care. Like, this is the problem with liberals. Like, they keep trying to appeal to the moral sensibility of these other people who have done nothing but prove time and time and time and time again that they simply don't share those values, or that their interpretation of what those values mean is so beyond warped that they literally don't mean the same thing.
It's
anymore.
Different. It's based on something else. There's some other categorical imperative. It's also a matter of priorities. If you're normal in American society, you do not care if your identity is not normal, or at least not considered normal. Whether you have economic security, on the other hand, is very important. For myself personally, I care about others' identities and them being considered citizens, normal, part of America. And I'll fight for them, or fight with them, rather, as an ally. But personally, if I just talk about myself, the economic security is kind of what's important, which I don't have. But otherwise, that's kind of, I can sympathize with where people who basically hate the liberal media, quote unquote, voted for Trump. Like, I could see their positions somehow. Not that I give a shit about, like, some of their concerns, of course, diametrically opposed to my concerns, but they will hear me out on issues about banking and control of money. At least a certain Trump supporter in Albany certainly did. So there's hope there, especially if we focus on local organizing. So to keep things more on the upswing now, we're going to discuss here on the Three Left Show ways of how to resist Trump or the Trump administration, and kind of the things that are happening locally. There's kind of progressive coalitions being formed across the nation, some small, some large, some with differing agendas, or rather they're just talking about their agendas now. But we're going to talk from our own opinions on that. So what are your thoughts on strategies for the coming year and beyond?
It's a good question. It's a very good question.
So then I'll go back to kind of something I prepared where cities like ours in New York City, some are declared as sanctuary cities. I think locally we have an effort to declare Albany a sanctuary city. And there was a kind of threat that from Trump during his campaign, I believe, so who knows if he's going to follow through at all, that he will kind of try to squeeze federal funding away from cities that are sanctuary cities. Just as Republicans will probably try to suck federal funding away from basically everything, from healthcare to education. So that means it's kind of up to local, regional, kind of state organization, and by that I mean government as well as civil society, that's all the nonprofits, that's all of the, to kind of pick up the slack or basically to be on its own, to separate itself from the federal government. If the federal government's going to be this broken, we need to, like, not just say, not have the attitude of who needs it, because apparently we did need it, but we need to act like we don't need it. Or we need to act like that it's not going to always be there, especially if it's going to be controlled and bought and run by the worst people we can imagine. So from there, there's the kind of idea of municipalism, which is kind of this general scheme ideas surrounding cities coming together to form a political confederation or being more politically linked, because various cities or metropolitan areas have more in common with each other than the rest of their state. Even though cities are supported by rural areas, farmland, etc., to kind of band together, share their own large kind of stables of resources, financial or otherwise, creative usually, that there would be a government, government or a municipality, a sovereignty almost, that is urban based or a series of towns. So locally that would mean like our tri-city area or just the capital region or the capital district. That we would kind of form our own, not an independent government from New York State, but certainly our own political entity that actually has, say, taxing power, or I don't want to say policing power, but the power to actually make policy and plan. We have a regional planning board or organization, but besides kind of coming out with reports, they don't have any actual political power or any kind of the ability to, say, manage resources, common or otherwise. And that's the kind of a direction that we could go in. That municipalism kind of has two programs, a maximum and a minimum. Minimum programs refers to improving welfare and creating pockets of prosperity for transition, not transition, for just general social transformation, actual reform to take place. Because otherwise it's not happening in the current system. Maximum program is then building people power to, maximum program is the transition from a representative government to a more direct or democratic government made up of assemblies and, let's say, committees, focus groups, more participatory government. So that's kind of a strategy to kind of band together locally because cities alone don't have the resources. Counties at times do. A lot of their, like, say, Albany County's social services depend on state funding as well as federal, like SNAP and whatnot. But if SNAP is cut, which in my household it has, and many others, something else needs to replace it.
Yeah, I don't know. I wonder, part of me thinks that the left is, you know, we're putting far too much effort and far too much of our focus has been on resisting Trump the man, resisting Trump's agenda.
As if he has one.
Well, as if he, I mean, his administration will have one. Whether he himself, you know, has one, right, I don't think he does, you know. But his administration will have one, whether that comes from him or his advisors. And yes, it's important to fight back against egregious federal policies. But, like, let's be real for a second, right? Republicans control Congress, okay? The conservatives dominate the Supreme Court. They dominate the rest of the federal court system. So,
and the state Senate.
And, you know, and many state houses across the country. So Republicans are going to have a fairly easy time enacting their agenda. And there isn't a lot that people are going to be able to do about it. You know, because let's get real. What has all the marches and chants and sit-ins and speak outs and, you know, all those in the world, what have they gotten us? They've still gotten, you know, basically the gutting of the Voting Rights Act. They've gotten the gutting of the Clean Water and Air Act. Like, protests and chanting and marches and rallies, they're only going to get us so far. And they're only going to be so effective in, quote, resisting Trump and the agenda of his administration, you know. But again, I think the point for me is that we're focusing too much on resisting Trump, and we're not focused on protecting ourselves from the danger in our own communities, right? It's not Donald Trump who's going to come around here and draw swastikas on things and leave threatening notes.
Or calling bomb threats to synagogues.
Exactly.
Apparently there's a rash of them in the country.
It's the supporters of his. It's the people he's emboldened. The people who are in every community in this country. Those are the people who we need to be organizing locally to defend ourselves from. To defend the people who are going to be under attack by the Trump administration, by the, you know, congressional and senatorial Republicans, and especially by their white nationalist and, you know, ultra conservative supporters who feel emboldened, who feel normalized by the outcome of the election. You know, it's like, again, let's be real. I think the best way for the left to resist Trump is for actual leftists to go out and buy guns and learn to shoot. That's the most revolutionary thing you can do in the present moment. Not to put too fine a point on it, but if you're not preparing to defend yourself, well, then you're certainly not taking the point from the, you know, again, Hitler is Trump and this is the 1930s comparisons, right? Mm-hmm. If you take those seriously, then the writing is on the wall and it's time to, like, not turn a blind eye to what it says. Mm-hmm. And take the appropriate measures in response. And I think for leftists, that has to be acquiring firearms, learning to use them. You want to defend communities of color? Prepare to defend communities of color. Prepare to defend trans communities. Rallies and speakouts don't defend them. Firearms defend them.
So it's a thought that's occurred to me.
thinking about gerrymandering, it's all been a legal process, and that, you know, oh, you can sue them all you want, but the courts are so damn slow, it'll be the next time to redraw the lines by the time your case gets anywhere. But in a lot of districts, they're one-party districts, just as Albany is a one-party town. But otherwise, let's just keep it to, like, say, Congress and the state houses. The districts have been drawn so that it's impossible for another party to win. They're already one party. So it wasn't that the party has not, like, an opposition party hasn't been banned, unlike, say, in Hitler's Germany. And labor unions haven't been banned. But the laws have been such, and the enforcement of those laws, or rather the kind of the gaming of them, have been such to make it basically that it's a, what is it, a practical, a virtual banning of opposition from whether it's a district that's held by a Republican and always will be, or a district that's held by a Democrat and always will be, or a state where it's so hard to unionize, there's really no point in doing so. Even if you did unionize, where will it get you? An example locally with Albany, the crossing guards unionized. That's a good move. But since they've unionized for a year, they've been, you know, represented and meeting with the city, and they still have not gotten jack shit.
Yeah.
They're still, like, they're waiting on coats. They do not have, they were talking to the city council a month or so ago when the budget was, as a budget comment. And then they lack coats, proper rain gear. And so it keeps their morale low. They have high turnover. And it's also, they're underpaid for the fact that even though it's only a few hours of work a day, it kind of stops them from having any other part-time work. And I was discussing this because we just had a school vote today to basically clean up charter schools' messes, but that's unrelated. Yeah, that it's like having no opposition. So I mean, it's just an argument for making that we're already have been under a fascist government. That Obama administration was a neo-fascist government.
Oh, I mean, Obama is absolutely a neo. I mean, I want to say, would call him a neo-fascist.
Certainly a nicer looking.
Obama, guy. Yeah, I wouldn't call Obama a fascist. I mean, I feel like fascist is a word that gets
thrown around too much.
It gets bandied around far too much. And is Obama a neoliberal? Yep. Is Obama a militarist? Yep. You know, is he a lot of things? Yeah. Fascist, you know, no. I would not go so far as that. But you're certainly right to say, are we living in a democracy? No, we are not. And we haven't been for a long time, right? And it isn't just, you know, and this is even before, you know, 9/11 and the Patriot Act, which, again, I feel, you know, that has sort of dimmed away and people sort of forget that most of that is still the law, and that, you know, we...
And it's only been expanded upon more and more, including the most recent addition to the, not the Patriot Act, but the Defense Against, Defense Authorization, that now that the Department of Defense has its own propaganda department, mm-hmm. or anti-propaganda department, but it's their own kind of Ministry of Truth where they're going to train journalists on how to report on proper news, meaning... go to the official sources, meaning the generals and the people who will draw
and
up.
To take their word for it and just, you know, be
appropriate,
servile puppy dogs.
But it's on the other hand, but it also makes me think about how Trump's election, Trump's win, disrupted and killed the TTP, unless it's going to be kind of shoved under quietly. But it seems that with Hillary's loss, the TTP was also unpassable. But maybe that's just a respite.
Yeah, I wouldn't jump to conclusions, you know? Yeah. Because let's face it, let's be clear about who the TPP is good for, who wants it, who controls and funds the politicians in our government. Like, you know, and even though Trump ran on opposing the TPP,
he's not going to,
The people.
We should be cynical about that.
The people around him do want the TPP. And they're the same people who would have been happy to have Hillary Clinton as the president and pursuing the TPP. And these things it's almost certainly going to happen because, well, look, it's frankly, again, from the perspective of the capitalist, it's essential to American security, economically speaking, going forward. There is a vacuum. If the United States does not step in
maintaining our hegemony
and fill it, exactly. And we're to the exclusion of China. There's a reason China is not part of the TPP negotiations.
Hegemony refers to a sphere of influence that we've been losing since pretty much either the 90s or 9/11. China and Russia have basically been expanding their hegemony, as it's called, sphere of influence, as well as Brazil. But basically anybody who kind of could challenge our hegemony, the Pax Americana, either has their government toppled or their government challenged or is basically called on the world stage by the U.S. government illegitimate somehow. But just as Iran's government is illegitimate, Libya's, Syria's, we start calling them a regime, it means we do not accept that state as being legitimate. And whether it was elected or its people are somewhat satisfied, doesn't matter. They're a threat to us, just as Russia's being bolstered up, and all the tanks that the Pentagon didn't want but had to buy anyway are now being sent to the Russian border. Oh boy.
Sorry about the TPP. So essentially, yeah.
Why does Trump's posse want the TPP?
These people want the TPP because, again, they know what the game is now. The game now is constructing these multinational trade blocks. This is what the game for the 21st century is going to be. This is how we're organizing our client states. This is how we're forming our, you know, our alliances. And we know that if we don't loop Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, Vietnam, you know,
South America,
if we don't get Southeast Asia if we don't get them organized to our benefit, China is going to pull them into its orbit for their benefit. And so ultimately, again, this is real politic, you know, how it works. This is, you know, the geopolitical
now to present the,
great game,
you
know, as it were.
Now to present the alternative vision of how the world politics could work, can you give a brief explanation of internationalism?
Internationalism is a very...
Rather than the zero-sum game between nations, just working, real politic, as you say, is basically doing what's in your own interest. And it's assumption that what's best in one country's interest is going to be against other people's interests, that there are winners and there are losers. And if there's one basic principle of socialism that I hold dear, is that we should work towards a society that does not have losers. Not that everyone has to be the winner or the most or the best winner, but at least no losers. And that means having trade deals where there actually is a kind of inequality between, if the country's richer, that a smaller, poorer country should get more out of the deal. So, as we continue and continue on in the Three Left show here, let's turn our attention to kind of a state story in the statewide story in last week, which was Governor Cuomo announced a kind of proposal for "quote unquote" free college, along with Bernie Sanders. You can take it away. I have the details as well.
You heard my chortle. I mean, you know, it's just one of those. Like, is it a bad thing? No. But, you know, to me, this whole episode with, the quote-unquote, which I'm glad you did, because it's not free college, right? It's free tuition, number one. But this whole thing is just so typically Andrew Cuomo. You know, he rolls this out. Here's the first thing that I want to say. It's a brilliant move for Andrew Cuomo politically, because he spent New Year's Eve vetoing probably the most important piece of criminal justice legislation that he's ever received in the public defense bill that would have...
This is providing money
this would have
so that more poor people
this would have
could
that,
have defense in court.
This was correct? This was a bill that would have seen the state assume the cost from the counties of providing public defense services. And so the state would have now been on the hook to provide, to make sure that every defendant in a New York state court has a lawyer where they're constitutionally, where they have that.
Actually fulfilling the constitutional obligation of providing defense.
And so basically giving real.
An actual funded mandate as well.
So they wanted to. It would have given real significant, it would have put some real meat on the bone of the Gideon decision.
Gideon decision being?
The Gideon versus Wainwright decision that establishes the right to counsel. Mm-hmm. So he basically, he vetoes this New Year's Eve after a heavy
fight to pass it in the first place, correct?
It was a fight to pass it, but he engaged in the very, it was passed in June. He sits on it for six months until the end of the year. Then
last day of the year.
At the very last minute, he engages in a very disingenuous negotiations with the legislature.
So to set up the layup that Cuomo, and this is something he does all the time, by the way, progressive things will come up that could even be passed, but Cuomo either won't fight to take it further, or he'll actually veto it and stop it. And this is something that happens all the time. And just a corollary, another fight within state government was a pay raise for the legislators.
Yeah,
they didn't get it. And one of our legislators, Assemblyman McDonald, in a recent interview, said how they're not going to get it for years now, because this is his reason that he gave was that. So I'm just relating it. Is that they couldn't decide on the amount of the raise. And because unlike with the judges, where they had a different committee that came up with the number for what raise the judges would get, so they got it, all the legislators had different numbers. Some were proposing what Congress is paid, which is $300,000. Others were proposing that it be what a city council member in New York City is paid, which is $150,000. And others were being more modest and proposing simply a cost of living expense increase, as we all should, and it would go up to $110,000. So pretty good. At the moment, I think it's $80,000 or $75,000. And so they didn't get it. But this means that the legislature, especially the Senate, basically there's nothing to bargain with them. So usually, this is how our state government works. They have to get something, either for their own districts or for their friends or their donors, and then they'll pass something progressive. And this even goes for a lot of the Democrats. But because of there's no pay raise, there's nothing to trade them with. There's nothing to trade it with. So because of this, I'm not sure any health care reform could be passed. I'm not sure any kind of like large reforms or anything of value could be passed except for some, you know, tweaks here to the budget, tweaks there, maybe solving a problem or two, but nothing that makes headlines. It's kind of why we didn't actually formally ban fracking, because all of the legislators, like, what are they going to get? So anyway, onwards. So I'm just setting up how broken our state government is, and at the top of it, or on the side, wherever, we have the governor being terrible as well. So his proposal for paying for tuition.
Right. So as I was saying, this tuition proposal, it's so emblematic of Cuomo as a politician, because the timing of it is just so utter, I mean, Machiavellian is, I think, you know, not an unapt description, because he had just spent New Year's Eve vetoing probably the most important piece of criminal justice legislation that he's ever received. In the public defense bill, which would have seen the state take on all the costs of public defense statewide. He vetoes this bill, which is going to make, you know, a pretty bad headline for him Monday morning. You know, governor vetoes indigent defense. Governor vetoes lawyers for the poor. Governor vetoes...
I saw him in two places, but maybe not more.
You know, so instead of that being the headline, Cuomo being the really sharp politician that he is, he gets Bernie Sanders on stage with him to continue this pivot he's got going on. Or, you know, at least he wants to manage the perception of himself as a kind of progressive Democrat. So, yeah, he gets Bernie on stage. He offers, quote unquote, free college, really free tuition. I mean, the substance of the policy is also so sort of emblematic of Andrew Cuomo in that it sounds like the kind of thing that's going to help
revolutionary.
The worst off, when really it's mostly a giveaway to those who are already fairly well off. Just again, think about the way that he described the program, right? Once you max out you know, already available public financing, mm-hmm. the state will then step in and plug the gap, so to speak. Well, look, the gap is going to be smallest precisely for the students getting who are better. Worst off, mm-hmm. who are already getting the most aid. So, yes, is it good for them to get that gap filled? Absolutely great. But guess who, like, but who are the real beneficiaries? Wouldn't it be great
if the state just paid for their tuition instead
of
all of this?
Of course it would be great, but, like, we're not arguing about what would be the ideal best, like, that's not going to happen.
For those that haven't been in a financial aid office, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, look.
I've only had to be in one.
Would a rational system be, like, a national university system that's totally free for everyone? Yeah, but, like, where we are now in this with this particular proposal is that it's, again, to me, it's structured to be a giveaway. And again, I say this selfishly as someone who, if I were, you know, 15 years younger, I'd be someone who would be getting a lot out of this program because I was from a family.
I think I would too.
Where, you know, I remember, you know, TAP is the New York program. I only ever got the minimum of mm-hmm. TAP because we made too much money. And so for people like me, there would have been a bigger gap between the aid I was getting from the state and federal government mm-hmm. versus what tuition actually was. That gap would have been bigger for me, and I would have been getting more out of this program than any low-income student, you know. And so, it's one of these programs that, again, look, it's just like Andrew Cuomo. It looks progressive on the outside. It's when you get right down to it, it's not that terribly progressive.
So I want to go, I'll go deep. So that's a good starting point. I'm going to point out my situation. I didn't even get any TAP of public assistance. Basically, it's all just Fed loans. But a lot of it was paid for, part of it by my mother, part of it by me. But the thing is, the tuition is actually usually the cheapest part of going to college. There is the housing. There is the board. There's the textbooks. There's activity fees. Mm-hmm. All of these things are still on the table. Students are still on the hook for this. And colleges are still free to raise money in all sorts of ways. Just as cities, rather than raise taxes because of tax cap, will raise fees that will hit poor working class, middle class, what have you, people more than those at the top.
Right. And of course, this is to say nothing at all about, right, and of course, in his State of the States, Cuomo was mentioning the student, the debts and this and that, but he's right, he said nothing about helping actual student debtors get out of debt, right?
Oh, yeah, that's
like there's nothing on the table about, you know, how we're gonna, you know, we're gonna make the public service repayment provisions more generous, we're gonna do this work, you know, like if you're already, if you
or drop the interest.
Exactly. We're going to do any, right? There's nothing coming from Cuomo to help the people who have already graduated SUNY. Right? Again,
this Well, the kicker here is that it was Democrats on the national level that, like Hillary Clinton, that fought to make sure that student debt is a problem by making it the only kind of debt that you cannot lose by declaring bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And of course, so many other things like making sure that federal loans are making a large profit for the Fed.
But again, to your point, fees and other costs are not going to go away.
If anything, they're going
to increase. And the fact is that those can still be prohibitive to plenty of people. And Cuomo didn't propose anything to help those people. And so,
with community college, certainly.
There's just, you know, again, and I get it. And this is, again, this broaches on the other thing we were going to talk about, and that's Cuomo's potential, his rumored, his still undefined 2020 ambitions, you know. And so is standing on this stage proposing, quote, free college, right? Does Andrew Cuomo want people around the country to think he's the governor who got free college in New York? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Does he want you to look under the hood and say, okay, what is this really doing?
And with Sanders there, it's almost like he's taking the mantle to be basically the Bernie-crat
candidate.
Exactly right.
Which, holy, that's Andrew Cuomo
has been. He has been working pretty hard for the last 12 to 18 months.
Persona has been on the ground to fighting.
To reposition himself.
Him, everybody.
As a, like, I mean, again, he, in almost every one of his state of the states, he's giving six this year. He's already given four of them. In every one of them, he's mentioned marriage equality as one of his big progressive achievements. Like, never mind that we were like, what? Not even, like, we were what? The after the 20th. I mean, we were one of the last, we are not in the forefront of that movement, number one, as a state.
Let's just point out, we have gender on the table year after year.
Not doing anything.
So we'll pass marriage equality, but we will not guarantee housing and economic rights.
But more to the point, Andrew Cuomo was the last person in New York State that wanted to do marriage equality. Like, Andrew Cuomo didn't push that on the legislature. Very much the other way around. The legislature pushed that. And so for, like, so for him to take credit for it, is this, and also,
smells like fracking.
That was like 6 years ago. You know what I mean? Andrew Cuomo's the big thing that he's resting his laurels on as a progressive is a six-year-old accomplishment he didn't even really want to do. And so, yeah, so he gets on the stage with Bernie Sanders.
Has he mentioned fracking?
He did not mention fracking, no.
That's odd.
He did mention, he did mention renewable energy. He mentioned today he wants to do wind farms off Long Island.
Wasn't that outside of the plan, and it was a big fight to get that in the plan?
He mentioned it today on Long Island that he's going to do wind farms off Long Island. That we have the target of...
Because that's what we really need.
The New York State target apparently is 50% renewables by 2030. He mentioned he's going
to be 80.
He's going to shut down Indian Point in 4 years.
Well, is that his choice? So, I mean, it basically has to be shut down.
Yeah, and we're shutting it down. We're not going to build any new nuclear power plants. Like, what the fuck, man? What the hell? You know, I don't know. I might be. Here's something. This could be a whole other segment. You know, lefties and nuclear power. I might be the only lefty who's like...
You're not the only one, but...
I'm pro-nuke. Like, nuclear power is awesome. The science there is great. And it's actually not that...
You're right. That's a debate we can have in
my It's a whole other debate, but like, it would be an interesting one.
I wanted to point out that in my tenure of going to college, this is 08 to 2012, tuition was raised. I went to City College of New York, which is a CUNY school, but it would be affected by this. Tuition went up 3 times. It started at $2,400 a semester, and by the time I left, it was $3,400. Then there's the fact that there's housing costs living in Manhattan. I did rent there's a condominium, and it seemed affordable at the time, meaning affordable for a dorm room in Manhattan. It was like $750 a month, but the rent would go up $50 every year. So, but when it hit 900, I was like, or 1,000, I was out of there. And I got a room for slightly less for the last year I was there. But that rent was a majority of the cost of me going to school. The tuition was pretty low. Activity was raised a few times. But otherwise, that was the only thing students could vote on, the activity fee. Activities that seemed funded enough, but otherwise were all crammed together. But otherwise other things around the school were being cut. Or meanwhile, all the investment in the school was going into new buildings.
Oh yeah.
The one that actually I enjoyed. The architecture school got a new building, and it's a good building.
Yeah. I mean, it's you're right. It's somewhat disingenuous for Andrew Cuomo to come out again, as he has always wanted to do, be disingenuous. And pretend to be a champion of education, especially of higher education, and its importance when he, as governor, has presided over the near constant cutting of funding from SUNY and the SUNY system. You know, it's just another one of these hypocritical moves for him where he postures as a center-left progressive Democrat, when more often than not, he governs as a center-right neoliberal, you know? I mean, that's... And of course, Cuomo, again, he...
Another part of the equation is something conservatives will bring up, which is the costs of college. Rather, just like with healthcare, the costs are of running a college or university system, that the proposals being offered, right? There's the paying for tuition, But then there's nothing to address the ballooning costs of like that tuition keeps increasing, that housing costs keep increasing. And this is mostly because in my college experience, administration keeps ballooning out of control, that you basically have this growing, ever-growing bureaucracy where you have an administration where they just keep hiring this army of assistants, and then they get assistants, and but not hiring new teachers, cutting teacher pay, cutting programs, cutting majors, also due to the cuts in SUNY. So just that there's the equation of paying for it, making it a social cost, that higher education, rather third tertiary education, is much like secondary education. That college is like the new high school. Or we can make high schools more like colleges and colleges more like trade schools, instead of just where the elite get trained to be rulers. But since I want everyone to be a ruler in their own way, that's why I'm for the, you know, everyone should have a little bit of college. Okay, so onward, we're going to talk, now we'll talk about Cuomo's ambitions. So we're working on the assumption that he wants to run for president in 2020 as the kind of Bernie-crat candidate. What's he going to do after being governor? And I actually heard it was also kind of speculation that Schneiderman will seek to be our next government, and that's our current attorney general. And this is despite, I think, as he ran for attorney general, he made a promise that he wouldn't run for governor. So I found it strange to hear that. Maybe it was coming from someone else, but they seem to hint at it strongly that, because this was something like, we had two attorney generals. This was Spitzer, became governor, then disgraced, steps down. New election after, now I'm blanking on his name.
Patterson.
Mm-hmm. But everyone hated him because he was just governor at the worst possible time. And but then you have another AG then runs and becomes governor. And so it would be really, I don't know if it would be ignoring the people somehow or just show just how broken our chain of command is that the governor is always the last attorney general.
AGs across the country. I mean, look, as the national legislature has become more dysfunctional, as the court system took on a bigger role in creating and setting and settling policy disputes, the AG position became a more prominent political position. And so people who have ambitions to be governor find it very attractive to be AG. And I'm sure there are plenty of people in the Democratic machine in New York State who want Eric Schneiderman to run. The question is, right, what is Andrew Cuomo going to do? And, right, the question of what he's going to do in 2020 is one question. The more looming question is what he's going to do in 2018. Is he going to seek re-election? Mm-hmm. And, of course, there are people who look, and again, you can look at the last 12 to 18 months, and you can see, okay, yeah, he's kind of done a lot to position himself as a, again, center-left, progressive Democrat. But very importantly, a center-left progressive Democrat with a very pronounced fiscal conservative, tax-lowering, spending-lowering streak. That, you know, I mean, he takes, that's to be a big part of what he runs on.
The best of Bernie
and fiscal Hillary. Discipline. Yeah.
He's like a combo of both.
He's like, he's, you know, he's, you're, in many ways, he, I think, you know, in he would have been a great Northeast Republican 70 years ago. You know what I mean?
Didn't Obama say that about himself, that 30 years or 40 years ago, I'd be a Republican?
He might have.
Well, he is a Republican. A lot of Democrats are Republicans. Cuomo is a Republican.
Mostly, you're right. I mean, I think that's the fair point. Most Democrats in the mainstream of that party agree 90% with their Republican colleagues on economic matters. I mean, that, yeah, it goes without saying.
Other 10%. You know, the question becomes, right,
if Andrew Cuomo doesn't run for governor in 2018, what is he doing for 2 years before 2020? Is he running for president that whole time? I don't see
how many parties Hillary had to go to. I think a year of.
I don't know.
Well, remember that the presidential campaign is a year and a half. So it most certainly would take 2 years to run for president.
Well, again, but a lot of people, they run typically run for president while having another job.
Hillary didn't.
No, Hillary didn't. Well, and she lost, didn't she? So, I mean, maybe there's a lesson in that for, you know, don't quit your day job.
That's a weird thing to focus on, though, out of everything else.
But either way, I mean,
if it were, if hypothetically, if someone were to say Hillary lost because she didn't have another job.
I personally don't see Andrew Cuomo not running for governor in 2018 because he wants to devote entirely 2 years to running for president. You know, while I certainly expect him to run in 2018, and I think that's the way he's positioning himself.
Yeah, I
mean, that or it's that or, you know, the only other explanation I can come to is, you know, that he's, you know, it's all a vanity thing. He's just trying to, you know, put together a kind of legacy for himself that, you know, he can ride off into the sunset and, you know, but.
In that case, he probably.
Does that read to you as Andrew? Andrew Cuomo doesn't read to me as the ride off into the sunset. Why are you suggesting? That I've done my job, you know. No, I think he's a very ambitious man who has eyes on higher offices.
He's certainly been climbing the ladder all his life from HUD secretary.
Favors and bullying.
He was on the federal level before the HUD secretary. And under Clinton, I guess it was.
So, you know, I have to think Cuomo's got ambitions.
And he's been tied to the Clinton camp all this time. And he was probably hoping to ride the Clinton coattails. Like, as once he stepped down from governor, then he gets some other high spot.
But now that Clinton's lost, you know, he's got to pivot to the Bernie wing. And so, yeah, do I think he wants to run in 2020? Yeah, I personally think he does. You know, we'll have to wait and see. But, you know, just again, this is wild speculation and wildly prematurely. I don't think he'll do that well. And I don't think he'll do that well precisely for the same reason
Hillary didn't.
For some of the same reasons, but also for some of the same reasons that Chris Christie thought he would do well and doesn't. Andrew Cuomo and Chris Christie are alike in the sense that these are Northeast guys. Their political style is bullying. And neither one of them are very good at concealing that fact. Everyone knows, you know, how they get things done. By strong-arming people. Neither one of them has any legitimate case to say that they're consensus builders.
On the surface, Cuomo doesn't say ugly things. I mean, I interpret them as ugly because of my views. But to your standard Democrat, I suppose, he doesn't say anything offensive.
No, but it's an open secret that Cuomo's tactics are thuggish. That's the way he puts pressure on people. He's not a persuader. He's a guy who puts the screws to you, who uses leverage and power. And ultimately, again, like we were talking about with the public defense bill that he vetoed, the reason that he vetoed it seemingly is that he wasn't going to be able to control it. He wanted basically.
That's the reason a lot of politicians give for not approving something. It's why we don't have. We'll never have popular democracy until we take it.
Well, not in New York State. New York State
if people actually had a choice, then I wouldn't be in charge.
Yeah.
That's literally the kind of shit they say. And a lot of bureaucrats say that too as well. I'm hiring you and make you me look
people
good.
People don't realize that, you know, New York State government really is, you know, Cuomo and Heastie and Flanagan, you know, in a room together. You know, those three guys, nothing gets done without those three guys agreeing on it. That's what worries me.
And despite people going to jail and all of that news, no rule was changed whatsoever. And the fact that no rules were changed was basically like, well, it wasn't worth doing in the first place.
The last, you know, ethics package that he passed last session was this really, you know, frankly, bullshit package that, you know, really ended up putting the screws to the not-profit community much more than it did to the legislatures on the inside.
Did anyone besides nonprofits notice that an ethics package was passed?
No, almost no one noticed because of course it didn't of course, it didn't really mean anything. Mm-hmm. The nonprofits know it's because their, you know, their just sort of donor disclosure requirements were drastically lowered to increase, you know, intentionally, to increase their regulatory burden. It was a way to pinch their nuts. I mean, yeah. Really, it was
punishing them.
It was a way to
that's so strange. That's, well, it's strange, but ingenious that the ethics reform. Right.
Punishes the people.
Was a matter of punishing the people who were calling for ethics reform.
And exactly. And that's Andrew Cuomo. That's him in a nutshell of, you know.
Oh, it's not just him.
He doesn't
let's make it clear. Oh, it's not just him.
Andrew Cuomo, but like.
We could replace him with Schneiderman. It wouldn't be that different.
Oh, no. Almost certainly not. I mean, I you know. That's the unfortunate thing, I think, that's going on about Schneiderman. I think there are a lot of progressive Democrats who see Schneiderman as the white knight who's gonna.
He was the last Democrat I ever voted for.
You know, Schneiderman, I'm sure he's a nice guy, doesn't, you know, do dog fighting or call people nigger.
He's not a ghoul.
Yeah, you know, he's not out there sucking the blood from poor children he's kidnapped from the Bowery. But, no. The differences between Eric Schneiderman and Andrew Cuomo are not that large. He might be less of a brutish bully, but Eric Schneiderman is not. He's not going to like.
He's a creature of the system.
Yeah, exactly. He's not going to sing.
Just as most Democrats.
He's not
going to
sing "Kumbaya" on the Capitol steps, and Democrats and Republicans in New York State are going to suddenly like start working for the people. I mean, he's a part of the political machine. He's going to play the game the way it's played. You know that. I don't think that he's going to.
And we all love games because they have rules that make things
rules
fair.
Rules that we can break, and that, you know.
Yeah, rules that apparently make things fair.
Yeah, I think that's one of the maybe the advantages to being AG and then running for governor is that as AG you get to dig out the dirt on people. You know, you have things you can hold over people when you occupy the big chair.
Let's see. What was the name of the federal attorney that actually persecuted our criminal leaders?
Prosecuted.
Yeah. Sorry. What did I say?
Well, I mean, I'm sure they felt persecuted.
Oh, persecuted. Yeah. Sorry. Prosecuted.
You mean Preet Bharara?
Yeah. Preet. Yeah. Yeah.
Preet Bharara. Yeah.
What's he been up to? Has he been doing
prosecuting,
anything?
Prosecuting, you know, financial malfeasance. Hopefully,
I suppose. But not our leaders. I think what did he actually say? Like, oh, Cuomo's next. I you know, I'm gonna doing the Cuomo.
Well, look, I mean,
but it never came.
Cuomo is just—he's good.
The election, he disappeared.
He's good. You're not gonna—you're gonna be hard to get Andrew Cuomo. Mm-hmm. You're gonna be hard to get.
Oh, that's right. That's right. He got some of his staff.
He got some of his guys. Yeah, he got some of his top guys. And again,
but that was it.
Cuomo, you know, you might get guys close to Cuomo, but you're not gonna get Cuomo.
That was the end of that chapter.
He already is putting in the state of the states. He's gonna put $500 million in the budget for another round of the Buffalo Billion.
So now it's the Buffalo and a half
billion. Well, they got $500 million last time, $500 million this time. So
oh, okay.
Together it's.
Now it's a billion.
Yeah, it ends up being a billion.
So it wasn't a billion before.
Well, he wanted a billion, only ended up getting half a billion.
Oh, well, now, only it was a half a billion.
And now he's going to follow through on, you know, for the other $500 million.
Yes.
But again, this is the same.
And now
like,
Central Buffalo
this
is
like the same project that. You know, this is the same vehicle through which he just got all these guys arrested for corruption. Like, that was the same product. So, like, you know, it's back to the same old tricks, you know, for Andrew Cuomo. I mean, nothing is.
I wonder what the data is on the.
Get popped down.
On the Hunger Games. The data for the Hunger Games, if how many jobs were made or anything like that.
I don't know.
That was, like, regional development money, which I know we got some in our region, and it's basically going towards, that's right, one of the projects, that's actually, some of the money's going to some renovations in Schenectady. So it's not like terrible things, but like usually the motive for doing it is like, this will, you know, make someone money.
Yeah.
Or it's supporting an industry. It was like the people who get the money are the industries that already exist and are already thriving. So it's just a matter of bringing this thriving industry somewhere that's supposedly not thriving, and then by having, say, home distillery or brewery in downtown Schenectady, Schenectady will be made richer, just like putting a casino there or a convention center here. And maybe that will work for a few years, just like any kind of tourist attraction. The first few years, it will make money, but then what happens afterwards? And I was just having a conversation this morning about the Olympics and how any city that has the Olympics, it costs them way more than it makes them.
Yeah.
And the same goes for most economic...
It's a prestige project. It's not a...
Neoliberal economic development, and that goes from convention centers to gondolas to skyways.
But let's definitely get some gondolas here in Albany. I want gondolas. I mean, I'm for it. I know that's a controversial
topic. You know, more buses would just be better?
No. A gondola... A gondola right to the train station would be... It would be my preferred mode of transportation. I'll put it that way because I can get to the plaza very easily.
Sure. Do you take the train often?
I do often enough. Anyway, I mean,
I can't afford it.
Let's just be real. Albany has one bus route that goes across the river to the train station.
Right.
And it's not even one of the ones that runs very often. Like. The 12.
That's what I'm saying, though. Well, I mean, that's what I will say. That's my counter proposal. That to have one, let's say a bus, it's like a 10-minute route to go from the train station to Pearl and State Street, right?
Sure.
Shuttle people to the hotels or the convention center. Mm-hmm. And that's a 10-minute route. To have one dedicated bus, to fund the operating costs of that would be a pittance compared to the $28 million for a goddamn gondola.
Now,
if we have a chairlift that goes from the north side of the city to the south side, that would be cool because we got a lot of hills and it's not exactly, there's not a lot of straight routes. So to have a straight route going from north south, but of course, like what's...
We just need a better way.
What's that servicing?
I like the gondolas because I think, I mean, the plaza it connects, downtown Albany with the train station in a more direct way. You know, the bus route is a little bit circuitous and it doesn't, as an Albany resident.
A bus shuttle going back and forth across the Dunn Memorial doesn't do it for you.
Doesn't do it for me. Like, this is the fucking 21st century. You know, I feel like a bus route is just not...
But here's the thing about the 21st century. With climate change upon us, and the absolute need to lower our energy and especially the building costs of our infrastructure.
Yes.
We already have all the infrastructure we need and all the roads and the highways that we not only have built but maintained over generations
about solar-powered
787
tie-dyed gondolas over the Hudson.
I mean, sounds perfect, right?
That's every environmental
But here's the thing.
Dream.
787 has just had an infusion of reinvestment so that it will be standing another 30 years.
Ugh.
Before the state can even think about depaving.
Demolishing parts of it.
I was at a meeting last year, all right? And there's a comment period, and these are the... state agencies that actually have the most participation, they actually take comments and they give them to the engineering department to consider. They'll make final, like, in this case, they will make the final decision, but at least they'll have, like, public comments for ideas. But, like, the guys are explaining, the most that we could hope for as far as taking down 787 was, like, lessening some on-ramps, but they said, like, no decisions could even be made for another 30 years.
Yep.
So, and this is from a certain ecologist writing about how, look, we have the road systems, so we should just focus on buses, more buses and bikes. We have all the paving down, and we maintain it, and there's the budgets and the structures to fund it are already in place. It's just a matter of funding buses to the point where we have so many bus routes and so many buses that we do not need as many car trips. And cars. And a big problem with Albany right now is that we don't really have the space for more or wider roads.
Nope.
But we have more traffic coming in.
Well, this is the whole problem. This is the whole problem with the plot. Like, there's no reason at all to have all these government offices right in the middle of downtown Albany. It's preposterous. it was preposterous for Nelson Rockefeller to propose it. Like, the government offices should be way up on the west side by where SUNY and the other government offices are. They should be all over there.
Make the Harriman campus denser. Yeah,
that should be, you know, triple the size of that and put them all over, like, they ruined downtown Albany to put all the state workers there, and all it does is cause massive traffic congestion, you know.
Or the need for basically all of these quick fixes.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, like...
Which are rather expensive for quick fixes. So I would say, how about we have a long-term fix, which is just a little, an actual shuttle service, which is dependable, that's every 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You don't need taxis.
Well, we made the mistake that we should never have built the train station in Rensselaer. There should have been a train station in Albany.
I don't know. Like, that decision was made before I was at a...
Stupid idea that was.
Like, yeah, I don't know.
Albany's train station should still be in downtown Albany. And again, as someone who likes the train, I don't think it should be... It should be more accessible. More accessible trains.
Well, the train tracks are still there, but now they're all dedicated to bomb trains.
You know, I just...
or another... In the but moment, I mean, basically.
Yeah. There are gondolas, I would take them.
But yeah, like solar roads and all that kind of stuff is really sexy. But when it comes to actually saving the planet,
solar gondolas are pretty awesome too, you know.
But it doesn't save the world.
Solar gondolas sailing over.
It doesn't sail the world and it doesn't save our economy.
Well, it's not going to do either of those. It's not going to do either of those things. It's just going to be a way to get from.
It'll put us on the map.
To the train station.
Just like Detroit's monorail. It saved Detroit, right?
Look at me. Let's look at North Haverbrook. You know, and Ogdenville. So
and Shelbyville. Wait, are you naming real places or
no? I'm not naming
real places. Yeah, they're the other fake places.
It's Ogdenville.
But I'm referring. But Detroit's monorail is real, and my parents rode it, and it's basically a loop that connects all their tourist attractions.
Boom.
And it didn't seem to.
I just think we should like.
And look how great Detroit is.
Gondolas, you know, if you could get from the train station right into into the heart of downtown. I mean, that's the plaza.
And the plaza
is great. Like
the connection to the plaza is another $8 million, and getting it to the bus station is apparently
if,
10.
If the like
or 20.
If they could replace 18, the shitty art on the plaza, then I would say yes. It's a great space, but if you put better art there and you get people right from the train station, gondola right over to a nice plaza. That's an awesome.
But where will all the modern art go?
Burn that shit. Like,
that's a pretty big collection.
Bury it somewhere.
I think I like three of the pieces.
I don't like any of that shit. Like, yeah. I'm a, you know, but I don't know shit about art. I like pictures of and sculptures of people, places, or things that are discernible.
Like object.
Yeah, I don't get abstract. Like,
don't do abstract.
I don't do that. You know what I mean? A whole bunch of like. Lines of different thickness of different colors.
It was odd stuff at the time when because of technology constraints to actually have paints that actually have these colors, pre-digital referring, to have certain blues was actually really hard. So part of the art was in fact the crafting of it. And with digital painting and digital printing, it's all been rendered kind of antique.
It all looks just like shit to me. You know what I mean? I got
well, it doesn't make you feel anything, then it's not, not good art.
Give me a painting of a bowl of fruit or a or a horse.
Well, now you really sound like a conservative now.
Like, yeah, I mean, look, I will say this for their taste in art. Like, picture a painting of a sailboat is at least like, I get that. It's a sailboat.
I just won't agree that, like, abstract art is a sign that our values are degenerating in the same
way. It might be. Our values are definitely degenerating. I don't know if that caused it. They might just be like,
no,
simultaneously evolving phenomena with no causal interaction.
Modern art is an architecture too, symptom of industrialization and tailorization, which is the kind of top-down industrialism which is all about monopolizing information and intellectual exploration, and that means art too.
I just like to
see art that can't be understandable by the masses.
If you're gonna sculpt something, it should be a thing. You know what I mean? Even if it's like a Pegasus or Hamlet.
I think you can have both.
You can have both. I mean, it's not about what we can't do anything we want. It's just about, like, what is...
Having studied art quite a bit of my architecture background, I like using the phrase metamodernism, where it's about going back and forth, dialectically perhaps, between two, not so much two, two opposites, but otherwise like two topics. So being naive and being a realist, you can have like a realist naivete where you like, you know, you're idealistic, but at the same time, cynical and know how things work, but idealistic in that knowing that they can be better or having a belief that they can be. And in art, it's referring to going between abstract and physical and objective. How that turns out is it's just usually just means being contextual and also having an individual vision.